join me in giving a warm welcome to Craig Maad and Matt Rothbard.
Welcome. Oh, wow. What a great audience here.
Hi.
Hey, Craig. What a packed house on a rainy afternoon. We're recording this live for our podcast. This is Taste. Thank you, Clayton, to our producer. Okay, first off, how many special projects members are in the house? Raise your hand. What do we got here? Okay, we're about, like, I would say a third, Craig.
Wow.
Gotta work harder.
Yeah, you gotta work harder. We can plug that at the end.
Who has Kisa by Kisa?
Ooh.
Yeah, okay. I like this. So there's some folks who maybe know about Craig's work and support Craig's journeys, but also some who maybe just have heard of Craig. So we'll go into a lot of areas here. Just love the book. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Just an incredible story about your friend Brian, and we'll get into that. But you, Craig, you hold place so closely to you in your writing, and I've been a fan of yours for 5 years, 6 years, and those pop-ups happen, and I just read every one, every word. I just have to ask you, when you're in New York, when you're walking around New York in the last couple of days, are there any places that you go to that you observe, any rituals? Because you're a guy of ritual.
Not really. I spent a lot of time in New York 15 years ago, 12 years ago, and I look at my Google Maps, which I was saving stuff back then, and they're all permanently closed now. There's so many.
Yeah.
It's like a graveyard of Google Maps. Like, there was a great cafe in the West Village called, I think, Minerva, that I used to go to. It just had this weird otherworldly vibe. It was like a little bit European, but not in New Yorkian. And I just kind of sit there, and everyone's kind of surly. It's kind of like being in Paris, but not in Paris. And it was so loud outside.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was this kind of this hushed, nice environment. I go there and I write with me and Malcolm Gladwell, probably.
Yeah.
Who's probably nearby. But that's gone.
Yeah.
And so thankfully, was it Three Lives and Co.
Yeah.
Has renewed their lease.
Okay.
And they're around for another 10 years or so, right?
All right, yeah.
Which I love. It's one of my favorite places in the city.
We're going to have a lot to talk about with the book. And I really wanted to start and talk to you about the writing process of Things Become Other Things, because it's really unique in publishing. You know, you start out, it starts out as a pop-up newsletter, and then it becomes a fine art edition, and then it becomes a Random House trade hardcover that is out tomorrow. You know, you've written extensively about digital publishing. We're not going to talk about that. But I just want to ask you about how you have written this book in this very unique process.
Yeah, first of all, I would not recommend it. This is definitely not the recommended process. But I went on a walk 4 years ago, almost to this day is when the walk started.
Wow, yeah.
It was May 10th, 2021, in the sort of height of COVID. You know, Japan had been locked down for over a year at that point. Japan didn't have the vaccine yet.
Yeah.
So I remember everyone was kind of talking about when they were gonna get the vaccine. It was coming in a couple months. And I was being careful, and I was like, well, let me go on this walk and let me go do this, and, you know, checking and being very, very above board about everything. And I basically had the peninsula to myself. And then I did this pop-up newsletter along with that walk. And it's funny, you know, you can go back through if you're a member and you can see the archive of it, and you can find passages that became chapters in this book. But, you know, it was basically, I did that walk, did the pop-up newsletter, wrote 30,000 words probably on that walk. Came back. I thought I was going to finish the book in 3 weeks, and it took, you know, another 2 years for the fine art edition to kind of come together. And then from there,
okay. So
the
let's go
house.
From there.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
an interesting journey because you release the fine art edition. You start with 1,000. What do you end up at? How many fine art edition of Things Become?
2,500.
So you ended up at 2,500.
Yeah.
But then how do you end up at Random House and then this expanded version? You know, for those who own the Fine Art Edition, it's very different.
It's very different.
And very expanded and very surprising. And we'll talk about how Brian played a role in the Fine Art Edition, but then also in the trade. But how do you get to Random House?
Well, it's kind of embarrassing, like, because it's like having all of my drafts public,
exactly.
You know, in a way. Like, the pop-up was one draft, the fine art was another, not a draft, but like more realized version, and then this version is very different than both of those. But, you know, it was like 2 years ago, right about now, I was out in New York trying to find an agent. I didn't have an agent. And trying to find a publisher. And I'd spent many years just getting rejected from everyone.
Crazy.
And the reason I did the Fine Art Edition was because everyone rejected me on that trip 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was sitting around just going, all right, well, look, what I really wanted was a partner. I just wanted a buddy. That's what I realized. It wasn't about like, oh, I need the validation of an agent, or I need a big publisher to bless me or knight me or anything. It was just, I just wanted a buddy to work on this stuff with. I'd been working alone for my whole life, essentially, and sort of doing all my indie work. And I just wanted that buddy, and it was crushing. I mean, it was really about 2 years ago right now, it was a really dark place. And then I was like, all right, I'm just gonna do this myself. I'm gonna do the fine art edition. I'm lucky enough that I'm friends with some of the best book designers in the world, amazing editors. You know, I know how to put books together, and I have great relationships with printers in Japan. I know how to do these things. I have, a warehouse that can fulfill orders, and Shopify setup and Craigstarter and all this.
Love the videos from the warehouse, by the way. Yeah. Have you guys checked out the videos from the warehouse? They're incredible.
So you can see Kisa by Kisa's production videos and stuff like that.
It's amazing.
So I was in the middle of, I'd finally gotten over, I was like, okay, I have to do this on my own. Everyone's rejecting me. That's okay, fine. You know, I kind of go for runs by the ocean and scream. And I had met with the printer. We had said, okay, this is the printing schedule we're gonna commit to. And then 2 weeks after that, Random House reached out to me. It was like, oh, we finally got around to reading your book.
That's amazing.
And we like it. That's we want it. So, but at that point, it was a little weird because I had already internally committed to the fine art edition. And then I have this preservationist scarcity mindset, psychosis, pathology, where I'm like, I have to protect everything. I can't give up control. I need to. Yeah. So Random House was very generous, and we were able to, I was able to say, hey, look, I don't think these editions are in competition with one another, and I need to maintain this autonomy. And I'm going to be selling my book for $100 a copy. And then we can do a bunch of rewrites and expansion and stuff, so it'll be a totally different thing. And God bless, Andy and Molly, they came around, and we were able to come to this agreement. And I maintain fine art rights, and Random House got this. And in the end, I'm just so, so proud of where this thing landed.
It's incredible. Those listening to the podcast, publishers do more of these deals because it really brings fresh talent in. Enough book talk. Let's talk about the walking itself. I feel like I want to get your take on these walks are extraordinary. There's rules. They're minimalist. You're not on your phone during these 20, 30, 40 kilometer walks. You're observing, taking photos. But then you dash to your hotel room and knock out on deadline, no copy editor, right? I imagine.
Oh, no.
3,000 to 5,000 words after. It's like a extreme sport. And the work is extraordinary. It is gripping when you talk to these people, and we'll get into how you can talk and how you interview. I mean, how did you come to this formula for these very minimal walks, but then their content engines, they're incredible.
Content engines.
That's a terrible word.
Just very reluctantly. Again, just a series of rejections forcing me to do this stuff. Almost everything I'm doing, or the way I'm doing it, is because I was just rejected by everyone.
Yeah.
I really wanted to write about walking in Japan, and I started going on these big walks, and the world was opening up to me. And I spent a good 9 months working on this huge piece for a magazine I won't name, and then got ghosted. And that killed me. I mean, it really killed me. And again, this whole idea of, okay, pathological scarcity complex, how do I protect myself? And so I started the membership program. Thank you, everyone who's a member. I mean, this is a direct product of that. I can't do any of this stuff without the membership program. I started the membership program to give myself autonomy, because I was like, okay, I need to create almost a boot camp.
Yeah.
What would it be like working in a newsroom? Where you're on deadline, hey, Mod, write about this, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so the walks accidentally became that. And so my rules are, no teleporting, basically. So no social media, no podcasts, no music, no news. I did a huge walk. I walked from Tokyo to Kyoto during the 2020 election. So I've done Tokyo to Kyoto 3 times now. And the 2020 election, I was like, okay, it's gonna be right a week after I start walking, and what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna tell all my friends, don't tell me who wins, don't tell me the results. And my theory was some farmer in the middle of nowhere in Japan was gonna be like, have you heard? So this guy won. And I was convinced that was gonna happen. And it turns out nobody in Japan cared. It was a week after the election, and I still did not know what had happened. And it was obviously complicated and sort of messy. But no one was screaming from the fields. And finally, I texted a friend. I'm like, all right, what happened? You know, and he's like, oh, you don't want to know.
Like 3 weeks later?
Yeah, like a couple weeks after it all went down. But anyway, just being, there's something about removing yourself from that maelstrom of chaos that we can kind of all be engulfed in, especially with the phones and teleporting. And I try to, on these walks, basically just meet everyone where they are on the road. So I can communicate with everyone. I've been living in Japan for 25 years. I can speak well enough to, you know, fluently, you know, talk about anything with any of these people. And I just say hello to everybody. And I have this like rule, take a portrait of someone before 10 in the morning. Yeah. It'll be like 9:45 and I'll be like, oh my God, still haven't taken a picture of someone. And I'll like just, you know, yell to a farmer, I'll knock on a door, I'll go in a tatami shop. I'll be like, hey, can I take your picture?
But then you'll write 1,000 words about the interaction.
Yeah, yeah.
On deadline again.
Yeah, and someone asked me the other day, they're like, you're trying to be in the moment and attentive, and yet you're thinking about all this writing you have to do later, and isn't that at odds? I'm like, no, it's totally in conversation.
Yeah.
And it just gets me to look harder, and it gets me to perk up about incredible turns of phrase that these people are kind of throwing at me,
yeah.
Or just, you know, weird things that are happening throughout the day. And it's given me this almost like theological belief that you can rest something interesting from any day.
Yeah.
Like it's the onus is on you to get that interesting bit out of it, because, you know, I'll do these walks, I'll be 30, 40 days on the road writing every day. So walk for 8 hours, walk 30, 40, sometimes 50K, and then get to the hotel and you just gotta start writing, editing the photos, do the draft, you know, and as I'm walking, I'm dictating into a note that just kind of keeps expanding. And I'll get to the hotel or the inn and then you kind of look through the notes, go, oh yeah, right, that's the thing I want to write about. There you go.
It's a great lesson for writers. I mean, you're basically publishing first drafts. It's just like it's a reason why sometimes the first draft is kind of good. And sometimes those natural instincts on the first draft work.
The final chapter in this book I wrote on it was the last day of the walk. And I had walked, I think the day was like 45K. And I was so tired. It was such a crappy start of the day. I mean, it was just terrible. The route was terrible. Yeah. It was hot. I didn't have enough water. I was dehydrated.
You never shy away from complaining about the heat.
The heat
in your writing. Shying away from your disdain for weather, which I love.
No, I don't complain. No, that's one of my rules. Is that I'm not allowed to complain about any.
You're not complaining, but yeah.
I mention it.
You mention it in a way that we're like.
I'm just mentioning.
All right, Craig's going through it right
it's
now.
It's hot. It's hot. I mean, Japan is gross. Don't go to Japan. Basically, from June 15th to like October, don't go to Japan. Honestly, don't go. You know, there's another big walker person who emailed me and was like, hey, when should I go? And I was like, don't go in July. And he came in July. And he had to abort the walk.
Yeah.
He walked for one day and then he was like going to walk for 2 weeks. He had to go home. He just left Japan. He just left the country, I think.
Wow. Well,
it's terrible. But the point was, is that I got to the hotel. I'm disgusting. I smelled death. My feet hurt. Everything hurt. And there's no universe in which I'd have been like, great, let's do 2,000 words now. Except I committed to the pop-up. And there was ostensibly an audience waiting for something. And I sat down, and I was in this totally hallucinatory state. And I wrote this thing, and that thing became the final chapter in this book. So again, I think about that a lot. Like, you know, it was like 11:15 at night. I just wanted to go to bed, but I had to do this. I promised, I made this covenant with myself. You know, it's like, you know, this weird thing.
Well, you had your members, too. It's like they're waiting for it.
Kind of, yeah.
There's a pressure. I mean, did Craig bail on day 31?
And the weird thing that came out of the membership stuff, and when I started it, it was very small, and everyone's like, hey, I want to do a membership. Should I do it? How do I do it? I'm like, don't do it. Just definitely don't do it. It's just so depressing and sad unless you're selling hundreds of millions of books and you're going to start off with 10,000 subscribers. It was so few people. And it took me about a month to realize, like, okay, these people are paying me, and I can divine a permission from this to go do these weird things, these big walks.
Yeah.
And so it came out of that. So, yeah, there's definitely, it doesn't feel like an obligation, but it feels like I want to honor that permission.
Okay. Well, many in the room have read your pop-ups, but an element that you aren't writing about in the pop-ups is your friend Brian from childhood. And it's really, when I got to read the book in advance, I was stunned about this story about Brian and your life as an adoptee and just really how you were able to weave your early childhood with your time in Japan. So I think that's like a really, for fans of Craig's writing, this is just gonna be a biggest surprise that Craig has this other part of his life. So how did you come to this idea that your early life and your relationship with Brian related to your walk to the Kei Peninsula over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the risks of writing and publishing in real time is that you feel maybe like you're unable to take certain risks or investigate certain things. So I think thinking about Brian, I mean, Brian was
set up who Brian is a little bit.
Yeah, Brian was essentially best friend. I'm adopted, only child. Parents couldn't have kids, and then they got divorced immediately. It was a very weird thing. And then Brian, I essentially met in first grade, and we were basically best friends all through elementary school. He was a brother. He was as close to a brother as possible. And then I sort of tested a little better. My town had no funding. It was kind of a mess. And Brian just didn't test well and kind of ended up going in a very different direction. And we graduated. And I mean, I talk about this sort of in so many things now. It's sort of a little bit of a spoiler. We graduated, and basically a week after we graduated, he was murdered, right? So this was pretty common. Not super common, but it wasn't that big of a surprise. You could imagine this happening to a lot of people in my town. And, you know, you're 17, and essentially half of your heart is gone from element. You know, it's like all of my childhood memories were with this kid. And it was my brother, you know, and I just didn't have the tools to process that. And I started, actually, the first thing I ever had published was a short story about Brian. And I could see, looking back at early writing, I was trying to figure out how to work through this. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to. And so 25 years later, you know, I'm doing this solo walk through COVID on this peninsula. And the peninsula is pretty economically depressed, and it kind of mirrors the kind of blue-collar tone of my town.
Yeah.
And you see kids, and you know, socioeconomically, everyone's kind of at the same level as we were, but the violence is gone. There is a social infrastructure there. There's support there. There's something happening there that we didn't have. And just walking alone, again, not teleporting, not having news or other things pulling your brain in other directions, you just start meditating on, like, why does this area lack the violence and, you know, and those paths that we were sort of embedded in. And so the pop-up was great to, in real time, think about the peninsula. And then when I started thinking about what the book could be, Brian started sneaking in. And then the first editor I worked with on the Fine Art edition was reading a draft, and he was like, hey, man, this is a book about Brian.
Yeah.
It
comes in later. So if you've read the Fine Art edition, there's just so much more to Brian in this edition, in this release.
Yeah, this book's a letter to Brian.
Yeah.
That's how this book is framed. So it opens just straight to Brian. And in doing that, the Fine Art edition doesn't shift to Brian until the last quarter, and the whole book is to Brian. And that allowed for a lot of other interesting narrative things to happen, because we were trying to protect Brian in the Fine Art edition, but now that Brian is foregrounded completely, it allows me to talk about history more, about what I've been doing for the last 25 years, about friends like John, my friend John, who's a really important person in my life. Book of John gets to appear. So
Seamus makes an appearance.
Seamus, the Irish priest.
Remember Seamus from a pop-up. I was so surprised to see an extended Seamus moment in this book. It's really just lovely to read when you know Craig's writing and you remember these moments from these pop-ups, and you're like, well, there's more to that story.
Yeah.
It's in this book.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about voice, because, Craig, you have obviously a singular voice when you're writing about yourself or just observing the world. But then you do something that's really unique. You, with your language skills, your Japanese language skills, you can create like syntax and grammar of the folks living in the Kei Peninsula that I think many, if not, I don't think any English speakers can have done. Like, it's an incredible feat, and they're very comical, the way you describe your interaction. So how do you think about the exchanges you have with these folks who are farmers and shop owners, barbers? How do you think about translating their voice into like a faithful version of it?
Yeah, because it's so Japanese, you know, it's sort of like British English or whatever. You have like BBC English, and then you have all the dialects. And Japanese kind of has that too. And you get away from Tokyo, and it gets really just syrupy and weird. and people are just funny and sing-songy. There's so much, like, you know, kind of like song to the language that never gets captured. And so all of my you know, in the middle, these pop-ups were sort of the foundation for this, but I started hearing, I spent a bunch of time in North Carolina randomly. So western south, southwestern North Carolina, kind of near Asheville, and hanging out with an old, one of my best friends in my 30s was this 80-year-old lawyer who lived in this little town in North Carolina, and I would go visit him once or twice a year, and we'd hang out for a week.
You're the best friends.
Yeah.
It's like straight up, like you make really good.
He was nuts. He was so smart. He was a Bernie Sanders supporter. He carried a gun for most of his life because he had all these people who wanted to kill him. And he just had these bizarre stories. Anyway, and I loved his voice, and I would record all of our conversations secretly. No, I'm just kidding. You know. And so I kind of have his voice in my head a lot when I'm walking in these kind of remote areas. And so I've tried to transpose middle of nowhere Japan to kind of western North Carolina,
yeah. You know,
Appalachian sort of English. And that's what I hear, actually, you know, when I'm talking to these people. And I think it's pretty true to who they are.
Yeah, I mean, because we are exposed to translation of Tokyo, Japan.
Yeah. Everything kind of in, you know, in Osaka-ben is different from Tokyo.
Yeah.
And, you know, Miyako Kawakami, all of her writing in Japanese is really wacky and dirty in a way that I don't think the English translations are amazing, but it's hard. Like, there's certain things that are untranslatable, and it's like, you know, verb conjugations and, you know, word selection and stuff like that. So I've just tried to take the vibe of these peninsula people and give them Southern American English.
Do you stay
English.
In touch with these folks after your walks?
Yeah, I just did. Yeah, I mean, well, because I keep going back.
Yeah, right.
So, I've been to the peninsula 20 times, you know, and I keep staying at the same places. And that's critical, is building these relationships. That's actually kind of, I see them as the most important thing of these walks.
Yeah.
And people go, why are you doing that walk again? It's like, well, because I want to see, you know, Nakajima-san. I want to see this guy. I want to see this person. And in February, I wanted to do a photo book of the people of the peninsula. So I've been not photographing the people for some reason. I just hadn't photographed that many people.
Yeah.
So I kind of called everyone I knew, all these inns that I've been going to for a decade, and I said, hey, can you help me photograph some pearl divers and, you know, tuna market people and you know, boat repairers and truck drivers or whatever. And everyone was so excited to help me.
Yeah.
And so I went, I did this 10-day, actually drove, which was kind of revolutionary. I rented a car and I drove 800 kilometers. But I was photographing from 4 in the morning till 8 at night almost every day. You know, these markets were open real early. And, you know, they introduced me to these pearl divers, these female pearl divers called Ama. Has anyone here seen Tampopo? The movie Tampopo, the movie about ramen, amazing, hilarious 80s movie about ramen. So there's a scene in there where he, you know, they meet the pearl divers, and like basically the women in that movie were the women I photographed, because there is no next generation. So they were in their 60s. One woman was 75. She's been pearl diving for 60 years. Yeah. She started as a middle schooler.
It's incredible.
And so going, you know, seeing them, and because I have these close relationships with the inns that work with them, they trust me immediately and they just bring me into their world. And so that that's the gift of doing
this. And that book will be released soon, right?
Yeah, so I photographed in February.
Yeah,
and again, this pathological scarcity mindset, you know, maniacalness, laid it out, sequenced in March, went to press last month, and it goes on sale next week. So
You got the metabolism, man, to publish.
Just go.
This is all the books. Can we take a little aside and just talk about the New York Times and putting Morioka on the number 2, or you didn't put it on there, but you wrote about this city, and then you became like an overnight, you were known in Japan.
Not really.
Sorry. Not really. You were known for your writing, but like, you became like a celebrity in some ways. You were on television, and like it was because of this one city kind of plucked from Japan, and it became the number 2 of 52 most travel, where you should travel. That's a crazy story.
Well, because I was doing these walks and they're very linear, right? So I'll walk from Tokyo to Kyoto, I'll walk from Kyoto to Tokyo, I'll walk the peninsula, and it's like 1,000 kilometers or 800 kilometers, and it's just day after day after day, and I don't take any transportation. And I just thought, well, okay, what are some other shapes of walks we can do? And I said, okay, what if I pick 10 like flyover cities, Japanese cities that you would never get off the train at, but maybe your train would stop there and because you're on your way somewhere else? What if I pick 10 of those cities and force myself to walk 50 kilometers in each city, spend three nights, four days, and just see what happens. And on that walk, on that project, I did, it was Hakodate, Morioka, Sakata, Matsumoto, Tsuruga, Onomichi. Onomichi guy here. This guy knows everything about Onomichi. He's great.
That's rad.
Onomichi, Onomichi, Matsuyama, Tsuruga in Saga, and then Karatsu in Saga, and then Kagoshima. Anyway, in the middle of all that, in Morioka, I kind of randomly picked these cities that were sort of a certain mid-sized city. And Morioka I went to, and it was just great. It was just wonderful. Everyone, you know, there was lots of cool independent shops, great coffee. People were lovely. I got an amazing buzz cut from like the most gentle, tender, like haircut I'd ever gotten in my life. It took like an hour to shave my head.
Oh, beautiful.
I was moved. I was so moved. That guy became the most famous buzz cutter in Japan by far.
Because you went back.
He was so overwhelmed. Yeah, we went with the TV crew and everything. And so the New York Times asked me, they're like, hey, can you recommend a city in the world to go visit? And I was like, yeah, obviously Morioka, you know, they should go there. And then they don't tell you where they're going to put it, because they're masochistic like that. And and then it comes out, and you find out when it comes out, and number one was London, and then number two is Morioka. And this would be like, I don't know, it would be like putting like Woodstock or something after London. I mean, it would just be, it's such a random city that it's like, oh, that's kind of cool, but like, why should it be number two after London?
Yeah.
And then they just pushed, there's a soba shop guy up in the city who'd lived in New York, and no one in Japan was really paying attention, and he was like, holy crap, this is incredible, because all of his friends in New York were messaging him and saying, dude, your soba shop is in the New York Times, because I wrote up this little thing and I put his soba shop in it, and he's like, this is like a huge opportunity. He went to the mayor, he went to the governor, and he was so like, great. Dude, like this is incredible. Like you should do it. They're like, what's the New York Times? You know? Japan is really provincial. Like we forget how provincial this place is. And he kind of pushed all this, and then he found out I spoke Japanese, and he was like, whoa. And then suddenly it was this avalanche of just every media outlet, every TV show. I was in the middle of a Tokyo walk. I was doing this like 7-day mega Tokyo walk, and people were like coming to my hotel room with like camera crews, and like, you know, hotel room was the size of the stage.
Yeah.
And they invited me up to meet the mayor, and I was like, oh, this will be cool. I'll just go, you know, say, hey, you know, congrats on your town. This is a lovely town. And they didn't tell me anything. And they bamboozled the hell out of me.
Yeah.
I showed up. And
press conference.
Holy crap, dude. It was like, and no prep at all. And they were like, oh, yeah, Mr. Mudd, and here's the, enter in here. And they opened the two doors, and it was just like a room like this, just full of like reporters and, you know, and like it was like paparazzi style, like rapid shot, like, you know, it was like 10 cameras on me, and the flash is going off. And I'm just like, what the hell's going on? And the mayor's sitting, you know, on the stage over here. I walk over, I shake his hand. He gives like a 2-second speech, and he goes, all right, he's all yours. And then he leaves. He leaves me, and then the questions start, and they're like, "Ah, oh, Mr. Mudd, how do we solve poverty?" And I'm like, you have the wrong guy. I just like your coffee. You have great coffee. Don't know how to solve poverty, but you have healthcare. That's cool. That's good.
That was great. Yeah. You would slide into healthcare. You were asked these banal questions, you would slide.
I always go into healthcare. Yeah. So I've done like 100 TV shows, and I did a TV show with the most famous guy in Japan, this guy Tamori-san. And his team emailed me, and I just ignored the email because I don't have a TV and I've never watched any TV. And his team emailed the soba guy. And like, dude, Craig won't respond to us.
He's like Martha Stewart and Snoop Dogg all in one, right?
He's been huge. He's been on TV every day for 50 plus years in Japan. He's like the uncle of Japan.
Yeah.
And so we ended up, my friend was like, you have to do this. He won't come to Morioka unless you do this with him. And I was like, I don't want to do this, but I was like, all right, fine, for the people of Morioka. And I went, we walked around for 2 days in Morioka, and it was like walking around with John Lennon. It was insane. This guy, this tiny, he's so tiny. He's 80. They first shot we did was in front of the station, and they're like, all right, Moto's on stand here. And then we've got, you know, six camera, this huge 40-person crew. Moto's on stand here. Okay, sure. And there was, like, another, like, announcer person. And then they're like, all right, bring him out to Moto. And he, like, they take him out of, like, some, I don't know, coffin or something. He, like, comes up. It's like Dracula. And he comes out, and, like, no introduction at all. And just he stands next to me, and they're like, all right, go. It was like, you know, it was like Lost in Translation. And he goes, I'm Tamori. And then the other person goes, I'm Mori's son. And I just go, ah! And I grab him, and I just start shaking him. And I go, dude, we gotta say hello before we start this. And I don't think anyone had ever touched Tamori's son in the history of his career.
Yeah.
Like, you know, three people committed suicide. It was really intense.
All right, we have a few more questions. We'll open up the audience. I have food podcasts I have to ask you. You know, you're usually, after 20, 30K, you're going to Konbini, you're having a few snacks, and you're pounding it away. But sometimes you get to have incredible food while on these walks.
I do.
Give us one example of a recent walk that you had a meal that really blew you away.
Well, honestly, on a lot of these walks, my favorite meal is Mos Burger.
Which is
Japanese healthy McDonald's.
Yeah, no, that's good.
They have an amazing fish sandwich and a great salad, really good salad, really good onion rings. But you're just eating every day. You're kind of eating a lot of fish, a lot of grilled fish, a lot of sushi. And the Iseiji, which is one of the main walks I'm doing in this book, the Iseiji is kind of the walk I tell everyone to do. If you're going to go, you want to do kind of a 7-day, 8-day walk, go do Iseiji. And I've written about it a bunch. I have a whole itinerary. It's easy to set up. But the food is just incredible because that peninsula, that area is known for Isei Ebi, which is technically Isei shrimp, but it's lobster.
Oh,
and
okay.
So some of these inns you stay at, I mean, the amount of food they give you is absurd. It's like, you know, a lobster the size of this table they cut in half, and the brain is kind of on display, and you're supposed to slurp it or something.
Oh, the best. Yeah.
No, I can't.
No, you don't do brain.
I don't do brain. I take like four bites.
Okay.
And then I like they look shocked because everyone goes to this area to eat this monster, and but then there's another inn I go to, and it's run by a husband and wife, father and son, husband and wife and son and daughter-in-law, and the son and father cook all day. They cook from 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. And the meal is just amazing. The inn is called Misuzu. Mm-hmm. I have their portrait in here, actually, in this edition. And they're just full of so much love. And the food is so incredible. And they serve something called karasumi, which is like this, almost like this pressed, it's almost like the body of Christ as fish eggs.
Yeah.
And he says he has the best in Japan.
Okay.
He's convinced. And it's this delicacy. And it's pretty good.
I want to ask you, write beautifully in the book about onsen culture.
Oh, yeah.
And like just how like the onsen, like the public bath, and just being around your neighbors and just being naked with your community.
Yeah.
It does something. And I think anyone who's visited Japan and been in onsen, I think you can feel a little bit of that. There's a release there, and there's a really beautiful section in the book when you write about it, and I just wanted to get for the stage.
No, I mean, I think every man in America is like, is my dick weird? You know, it's like, when you're 14, 15, you're like, my dick is so weird. You know, like, I think everyone thinks that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the first time I was taken to a hot spring, I was like, whoa, there are way weirder dicks out there.
Yeah.
There's so many dicks, so many shapes. I didn't know this was possible. And I think there's something really beautiful about seeing all these dicks. And the sooner you can see the more dicks, the better. That's the takeaway I've gotten from it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it is. But like being naked with people is great. And you know, and I take a lot of Americans will come, friends, we'll come and we'll walk together, and you know, we're staying at these inns and they have communal baths and we bathe together, and this is literally the first time these people, and they're in their 30s or 40s, 50s, 60s, have ever been naked with someone else that, you know, and by day three or four, a lot of them said to me, like, look, this is the most comfortable I've ever been with my body.
Yeah.
You know, I've never done this before.
You see your future right there.
Yeah,
like, it's right
it's
there in front of you. Or it's not terrifying. It's like kind of comforting to know.
Well, sometimes it's very terrifying.
Okay. Have you been out to Brighton Beach?
No, I have not.
That can be terrifying.
I mean, I've seen some testicularity that no, No man should ever gaze upon.
Yeah.
But you know, everyone's cordial.
Yeah, and when you're raised that way, you just have the body image is different in Japan.
It's different.
It's a different like relationship with your body.
And everyone is, if you look like me, everyone's trying to look at your dick. Because they've never seen, like most of these farmers have never seen a white guy naked. And so they're, everyone's kind of interested. Everyone's trying to like peek.
You pose for selfies?
I do. We do some bath selfies. But no, it's funny. And just the crazy antics in the changing room. Like these farmers are so comfortable with their nudity.
Yeah.
And they look like their skin's almost painted on because of their tans are so intense. But they'll be, doing spread eagle stuff on like benches and, just bending over in crazy way right in front of you.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's the comfort.
Yeah.
It just makes you realize how uncomfortable you are, with your nudity. So I love it. And one of our friends here, the Onomichi man there, he writes beautifully about Sento culture. And what's the name of your Substack? Dispatches from Post Growth Japan. Great newsletter. He writes about Sento culture. And I think the loss of that is quite sad. It's quite depressing because of that communalness of sharing nudity and kind of having this communal space. And so it's fun to go in the countryside to see where it's still kind of revered and pretty active.
Well, final question, and be thinking, we'll be calling on the audience. Where are we at with the kisas right now?
Yeah.
Like, you did a lot of work around, these dying kisas throughout rural Japan, and also in Tokyo. I loved your jazz pop-up, which was about jazz bars and the death of jazz bars. And depopulation has been well covered in the press in Japan and Korea and other places. But as a journalist yourself, as somebody who documents the death of culture, I mean, that's a heavy topic. Well, I guess we're checking in on kisas right now. Where are we at? Like, are they really going away as fast as you first wrote about?
Yeah. So kisa, short for kisaten, which is basically mid-20th century Japanese style cafe. So the analog would be essentially like a New York diner.
Yeah.
And like New York diners, they're disappearing, and we're sort of at the end of the generation who had committed their lives to it. Not because it's funny, you see these old kisa that are left and people have been working at them, the owners have been there for 50 years, 55 years. And it's not because they were young and were like, oh my God, I have to run this kisa, I love it. So it was because they didn't want to go to an office.
Yeah.
And there weren't other options. And so they kind of did it reluctantly, and there's sort of a survivorship bias of the ones that are left, of just the ones that happen to be good. There's a lot of bad ones, and so the ones that are left are kind of good. But it's the end, it really is the end of this era of people committing to a community hub like that. Again, connected with Sento culture. A kisa is a place where you have the regulars. They come, they smoke, they have their morning set, they gossip. And in the countryside, because of depopulation, a lot of villages, all they have left are barbershops and kisa, that's it.
Yeah.
And so when I do these walks, I mean, the whole reason I started writing about kisa is just because there's literally nowhere else to go to have lunch. And they serve pizza toast, so I was eating a lot of pizza toast.
Yeah. Describe what pizza toast is.
It's exactly what you think.
I mean,
it is.
But it's like the Japanese version of pizza sauce. Like, let's break it down a little bit.
Thick sliced bread, like really
milk
thick.
Milk bread. Right.
So the whitest bread you can
but
smoosh
Japanese
it.
Japanese milk bread is kind of bomb.
It's good. It's good. Totally good. And just really basic tomato sauce, maybe some peppers, a couple onions. Salami, and like essentially American sliced cheese.
So like a yellow cheese?
Yeah, basically, yeah. And in a toaster oven. I mean, the whole thing was post-war, these were mainly post-war institutions. So it's just, what can we do with the smallest possible set of ingredients and also the simplest kitchen? So you just have a little toaster oven, you can kind of make pizza toast. You can do toast, pizza toast, and then they do Napolitan spaghetti, which is basically just spaghetti with ketchup and some sausages.
Yeah.
Like a step above Chef Boyardee barely, basically.
And the coffee is love legend.
And the coffee, there's, it's pour over, but also cloth drip.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cloth drip at these kisa. And then siphon, in America in the last decade, there's been kind of this, you can go to Blue Bottle, I think the San Francisco Blue Bottle had a whole siphon thing, and you'd go and it would be $18 for a siphon coffee. But siphon was the standard for a lot of Japanese kisaten in the 60s and 70s. You go and it's like $2 for a siphon coffee in a lot of these old places.
Yeah.
So.
So, Craig, what's next? I mean, you're on book tour for the next several weeks, I know, but like
Six weeks.
Your metabolism for creating books and pop-ups and content and everything is really high. So I know you have mentioned on the membership that you have several book projects for members, but what's the like roadmap right now looking like for you?
Honestly, just survive this. That's it. This is 6 weeks on the road.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing, it's like 10 events. I'll be in Washington on Friday, off to San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles. We're doing some dinners there, trying to set up a members only dinner, like a little thing for members over there. I'm just trying to, you know, have fun.
Yeah.
Just try to enjoy this and just be present. I'm treating this essentially as like a walk. You know,
yeah, right.
Again, try to stay off.
No pop-up, though, at the end of our talk.
No pop-up.
No.
No, I can't.
Well,
I can only do the pop-ups because I finish at five. I finish walking at five, and then I'm just silent.
Yeah.
From 5 to 10 or 11, just working. And so this is too
special. But you're working on, like the jazz bar
Oh, for the other books?
Yeah. Some other books in the works.
Yeah, the jazz Kisa thing.
Yeah, I love that.
I did 3 weeks of visiting these North Tohoku and Hokkaido jazz Kisa, and I went to, I think, 20 or 21 of them 2 years ago, and already I think four of them have disappeared because the owners have died. So again, we're at this stage where there's like 10 to 15 years left for whatever the originals
are. It's incredible when
are.
You say
so,
it that way.
And I was thinking, well, okay, now I have to go to Shikoku, and I should go to Kyushu, and I should go to, you know, all over Japan. I should visit these jazz Kisa to do a book, and really I should just write about Northern jazz for now.
Yeah, you have it.
Just do it. And so, I mean, that's also interesting, thinking about what are the constraints of, you know, for these projects, because they can just keep expanding forever.
Yeah, you gotta like tamp down.
So, you know, do Northern jazz, and I'll go do Shikoku, Kyushu.
I can't wait to read that. Thank you, Craig. This book is incredible.
Thank you so much
for joining. And we're gonna open it up for, so we'll give a round of applause for Craig. I really hope you all can read the book. And I think we're gonna open it up for a few questions via the microphone. Raise your hand. Question, who wants to kick it off? Somebody, yes. Yes. Oh, no? Can I call on somebody? No?
Okay.
No, we're right here. Someone thank you, here. You're great. First question.
Hi, thank you for this. What have you noticed has changed the most since you've lived in Japan?
In the cities or countryside, or both?
Right.
Well, first of all, when I moved there 25 years ago, Japan was forgotten. If you just look at the tourist numbers, Japan now gets in 1 month more than we got in a year, far more than we got in a year. Also, China didn't exist as a tourist, as a country that created tourists. And so there was zero Chinese tourists 25 years ago. Now it's something like 60 or 70% of all tourists are Chinese. So that's really interesting to see these sort of economic shifts throughout Southeast Asia. Indonesia, the tuna boats are mainly manned, and actually there are almost no women on these boats because they believe it's bad luck. The boats are named after women. They don't want to have women. This is what they say. And they're helmed by Indonesian workers. Even now, that's the case. And it's getting harder and harder because Indonesia has gotten so economically stronger in the last 25 years that they can't pay them enough. So for Indonesians, it used to be incredible to come and be able to work on a boat and send money back home. And now it's sort of like, well, should I do that? It's a dangerous job. It's really hard. I mean, it looks terrible. Mm-hmm. They should be getting paid way more than whatever they're getting paid, I'm sure. So those changes have been interesting. And then the aging of the population, the countryside is just denuded of people. You know, you just don't see kids. You don't see a lot of these cities that 25 years ago would have been active. They're called shutter streets now. So all the shutters are closed on the shops because everyone's died and there's no economic incentive to run a shop there. So seeing that and seeing how municipalities are kind of being brought together to form bigger, you know, just sort of saying, okay, these three towns are now one town. And talking to the old timers about kids, you know, the elementary school used to have 150 kids. Now all the classrooms, there's 14 kids. So stuff like that. And just, you know, how are they dealing with it? What are they thinking about? But also seeing the immigrant influx in service workers. So in Tokyo, 25 years ago, you would never, ever, 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 anywhere, ever, ever see a non-Japanese person working anywhere, ever, ever. And now I'd say 50% of the convenience stores, the people behind the counter are non-Japanese. A huge percentage are Nepalese, actually. There's a massive Nepalese population working in Tokyo. And there's a Okinawan soba shop that I've been going to for 25 years. And 25 years ago, everyone there was Japanese. You go now, it's 9 Nepalese workers and 1 Japanese worker. And they speak great Japanese, and they love it, and they're grateful to be here, and they're excited. So I'm curious about the political situation about supporting these people and making sure that they're taken care of well, and that they're given, on ramps to becoming full-fledged citizens, and they have so much pride of being there, and we want to nurture this, and we want this to be great. And so I'm talking more and more with politicians about how do we make sure these people are loving it, and want to integrate fully, and and how do we support them in the best way possible. But I'll be in the middle of nowhere, and a Nepalese guy will ride by on his bike, and he'll stop, and he'll be like, "Who are you?" I'll be like, "Who are you?" He's like, "I work at the bento shop." He's 23, 24 years old, and all he wants to know is how many girlfriends do you have? he's like, "How do I get a Japanese girlfriend?" That's all they want to talk about.
Oh, really?
So that's all new. None of that existed. And then the tourism thing is, in general, in Tokyo, is overwhelming.
More questions. We have one over here. You want to just yell it? Yeah.
In a recent conversation with Tim Ferriss, you talked about a professor that shaped your life, the kind of scary one. Is being a teacher or professor something you would ever think about? I just asked, I would take that advice.
Many of us would.
I'll give you a free membership. Yeah, I think it was a high school teacher that was sort of scary if you weren't playing ball. But if you were trying, he was totally on your team. But he was, the sort of guy where if someone was fooling around a lot, he handed a lighter to the person sitting next to him and said, "Light him on fire if he talks again." Jokingly. He was sort of the Dave Letterman school of comedy of biology teachers. But he was incredible. But, the teaching thing, I feel like I'm trying to figure it all out. I feel like I don't know anything. I feel like I don't know what I'm doing with any of this stuff. And the membership program has become the place where I just try to talk about what I'm doing. And the board meetings for members, I do a board meeting every 6 months. And I just say, okay, what do we do in the last 6 months? What am I looking to do in the next 6 months? And then I open it up to Q&A, and the questions are always amazing. And I have the archives of all that stuff up, and we have kind of indices for all the questions. And so I feel like that's a pretty good archive, and that's kind of the best I can do right now. But I just feel like there's still so much I'm trying to figure out. The membership program is me talking to myself when I was 20, wishing I had that, wishing I had the voice to talk about these things, and that's kind of how I frame it.
Yeah. Another question right there.
Yeah, I'm curious. I've heard you talk a lot on podcasts about your writing, but less so about your photography.
Yeah.
I'm curious,
I mean, photography, I'd always been drawn to it, but we couldn't afford a camera in high school. So all throughout my teenage years, no one had a camera around me. And then finally, when I got to Tokyo, I could afford, there were so many used camera shops, and for $100, you could have a great camera set up. And I basically, with everything in my life, I taught and was influenced by the internet. I mean, my biggest photography influences were photo.net. I don't know if anyone knows this website. I spent all of when I was 19 and 20 in the computer lab just reading and reading and reading and trying to understand how to take pictures and how to think about pictures. And then as I've gotten older, Becky Young, it was a big influence for me. She's a photographer in Philadelphia. I studied with her, and just hearing about how she thinks about the world. And she gave me a lot of sort of permission to be really zany and bizarre and spiritual in the practice. But then, obviously folks like Eggleston and Stephen Shore and, a lot of the countryside walking I'm doing is sort of drawing on them. But there's a new generation of street photographers that are kind of appearing on YouTube and Instagram right now. And Trevor Wisecup, I don't know if you know this guy, just a really interesting, wacky, totally out there guy. And I think what's fascinating about this younger generation, first of all, no one under 30 shoots digital at all. It's really, really fascinating how nobody shoots digital. Everyone shoots film. And I went back to film 2 years ago. I'd grown up with, you know, shooting film 1920, basically from 19 to 25, 26, had a darkroom in my apartment, was developing everything on my own, and then digital started getting better, and it was, if you'd dealt with film, digital was just so obviously so much better that it felt like, why would I want to keep doing this? And you could move faster, and it felt good. And then I think something flipped in the last decade, last 5 years especially, with we're so in the phones, Apple Music sucks, Spotify, it's just like you have no relationship with media. And I think the younger generation kind of intuitively feels that. And it's been fascinating to engage with younger and younger photographers, and they all shoot film. And I think that slowness and I think the loop of engagement is really fascinating.
Yeah.
Where it's not immediate. You can't immediately look, chimp, and check if you've got the shot or not. And I was suspicious when I went back to film 2 years ago. Kind of, I went back on a lark. I had my Hasselblad sitting on the counter, and I put a roll of film through it. And just taking it out, something felt really special about that. And I was just immediately back in. And so this new book that is coming out next week is...
No, tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Yeah. Well, this was coming out tomorrow.
Yeah,
the photography book that I shot in February was almost entirely film.
Yeah, okay.
And that's sort of...
The labs, downtown, like the photo labs are popping.
No, it's...
They're busy. It's just crazy.
It's bananas.
It's like last five years.
And if you talk to the labs in Tokyo, too, I mean, the tourists coming with that need to get film developed. It's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. I think we have time for one or two more questions. A quick one there. Right there on the right.
Over here we've got... Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just think having a deadline is good. That's it. That's kind of like, that's 99% of it. It's just, I need a deadline. I can't work without a deadline. I look at my 20s and I'm like, there was so much lost time in my 20s because I didn't have any deadlines. And again, going through that magazine thing and getting ghosted and rejected and all this, and I realized intuitively I was just creating a set of deadlines for myself. That's what it boiled down to. And so getting to the end of the day, even when you're exhausted, and learning how to create that space where you just have to get it done, you have to do the work, I've now done that for hundreds of days, and that's a powerful thing to feel. And so now if you say, you gotta finish, Marnie, who's been amazing, PR, helping me out, she's orchestrating so much stuff and getting me, essays and stuff to place in various magazines. Marnie comes to me with any pitch, and I'm just like, oh yeah, easy, whatever. Yeah, give me a throw. Yeah, you build up this muscle where you're just like, okay, if I sit down and I have the deadline and I need to get it done, and you give me the word count, I'm gonna get something done. And I didn't feel that 5 years ago. I couldn't do that 5 years ago. So I started building that muscle when I was 38, 39. Which is like probably way too late. But I was reading a lot, and I was doing a lot of other things, but I was loose about deadlines. And the pop-up walks especially taught me how to have a deadline. And Ridgeline, now it's not weekly, even though it should be. It's technically supposed to be. But for the first 2.5, 3 years, it was religiously weekly. Even during the big walks, I would keep the Ridgelines going. And that was important to me, just to, again, build that muscle and honor that muscle.
Great, one more question. What do we got? There was one right there, yeah.
Hello. Hey! There's so many old faces here. Not old, I mean.
Familiar faces.
Familiar.
Familiar.
We've known each other for 22 years, 23 years?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yes, I remember you are all process of publishing. You're publishing yourself, designer.
Yeah. You just have to give up all control. So the question was, Kosuke's known me for 20 plus years, and he's seen me run through all these book parties in Tokyo and do independent publishing stuff and be the designer and sort of editor and everything. And his question was, how does it feel to work with a big publisher now? And everyone, first I was lucky because I was able to maintain fine art rights, right? So that was really important. So I felt like my edition that I did a couple years ago, great, we did that. and here's kind of a canonical fine arty version of it. And so that made me so chill about the rest of the process. And then everyone told me, Craig, just be ready, it's going to be terrible. So everyone told me it was working with a big publisher is the worst thing in the world. You're going to be disappointed by everything. That's what everyone told me. They were just like, Craig, be ready to be disappointed. You know, I was like, all right, this is clearly going to be the worst thing I've ever done in my life. And so I went into with that mindset, and it turned out it was great. You know, Molly, my editor at Random House, was fabulous. And again, like I said earlier, I was looking for a buddy to go on this journey with, and Molly was just such a great buddy, you know, and she totally got the book. And the editorial process for building this version out was she went through the other draft, the other manuscript, and put 300, 400, 500 questions in it. And I just responded. She's like, you don't have to respond to all these. I responded to every question. And they were wonderful. They were wonderful questions. I wanted to respond to it. I felt relaxed about the process. And I think this edition especially, there's a relaxedness to it, a kind of playfulness that I'm really proud of where it landed. And then I think it feels great, like in hand. I think that the size is just about right. I think the cover came out great. The interior design, you know, I knew we weren't going to be doing four color. And you don't want to do four color. Four color, if you do four color, the expectation of the reader gets so high. And you have to do it right.
You have more margin of error. I mean, it's so much more error.
You're doing a bunch of four-color stuff. Yeah. And it's just so complex.
Corrections are crazy.
And so leaning into sort of mass markety hardcover design, knowing that language, knowing the kind of paper it's going to be produced on, and then redeveloping all the photos for that, rethinking the layout for that, that was also really freeing. And I can't think of another book that looks like a book like this that's come out of Random House. And I just want to call out the designer. I'm being a real jerk for not knowing the designer's name. Sachi Chandirami. Jesus, I'm such an asshole. Sachi Chandiramani.
Great.
Did the cover and possibly also the interior design. Sorry, it was just such a kit. There was a lot going on with the process. But it came out great. And so in the end, giving up that control, it was fine because the team was wonderful. So
that's great.
Lucky.
To hear that. It's really nice.
And it's not just because they're sitting here.
I know they're like literally sitting in the front row, but no,
I'm not lying.
It's wonderful to hear that, you know, the death of books is no longer apparent. Your famous New York Times article from like 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We won't talk about that.
Let's not talk about that.
Print is not dead. No,
yeah, print is not
I'll
dead.
I'll leave it at that. Everyone knows that article. We want to talk about it. Thank you so much for joining us, Craig.
Thanks for coming
out. Major congratulations. Love this book. Thank you to Clayton, our producer here on the show. The show is This Is Case. You can download it and check out the conversation there, too.
Thank you.